2. With conspicuous nonchalance, Verhovensky lounged in the chair at the upper end of the table, almost without greeting anyone. His expression was disdainful and even haughty. Stavrogin bowed politely, but in spite of the fact that they were all only waiting for them, everybody, as though acting on instruction, appeared scarcely to notice them. The lady of the house turned severely to Stavrogin as soon as he was seated. "Stavrogin, will you have tea?" "Please," he answered. "Tea for Stavrogin," she commanded her sister at the samovar. "And you, will you?" This was to Verhovensky. "Of course. What a question to ask a visitor. And give me cream, too. You always give one such filthy stuff by way of tea, and with a name-day party in the house." "What? You believe in keeping name days, too?" The girl student laughed suddenly. "We were just talking of that."
"That's stale," muttered the schoolboy at the other end of the table.
"What's stale? To disregard conventions, even the most innocent, is not stale. On the contrary, to the disgrace of everyone, so far it's a novelty," the girl student answered instantly, darting forward on her chair. "Besides, there are no innocent conventions," she added with intensity. "I only meant," cried the schoolboy with tremendous excitement, "to say that though conventions, of course, are stale and must be eradicated, yet about name days, everybody knows that they are stupid and very stale to waste precious time upon, which has been wasted already all over the world, so that it would be as well to sharpen one's wits on something more useful."
"You drag it out so. One can't understand what you mean," shouted the girl.
"I think that everyone has a right to express an opinion as well as everyone else, and if I want to express my opinion like anybody else—"
"No one is attacking your right to give an opinion," the lady of the house herself cut in sharply. "You are only asked not to ramble, because no one can make out what you mean.
But allow me to remark that you are not treating me with respect. If I couldn't fully express my thought, it's not from want of thought, but from too much thought," the schoolboy muttered, almost in despair, losing his thread completely.
"If you don't know how to talk, you'd better keep quiet," blurted out the girl. The schoolboy positively jumped from his chair.
"I only wanted to state," he shouted, crimson with shame and afraid to look about him, "that you only wanted to show off your cleverness because Mr. Stavrogin came in. So there!"
"That's a nasty and immoral idea, and shows the worthlessness of your development. I beg you not to address me again," the girl rattled off.
"Stavrogin," began the lady of the house, "they've been discussing the rights of the family before you came, this officer here." She nodded towards her relation, the major. "And of course, I'm not going to worry you with such stale nonsense which has been dealt with long ago. But how have the rights and duties of the family come about in the superstitious form in which they exist at present? That's the question. What's your opinion?"
"What do you mean by come about?" Stavrogin asked in his turn. "We know, for instance, that the superstition about God came from thunder and lightning." The girl student rushed into the fray again, staring at Stavrogin with her eyes almost jumping out of her head. "It's well known that primitive man, scared by thunder and lightning, made a god of the unseen enemy, feeling their weakness before it. But how did the superstition of the family arise? How did the family itself arise?"
"That's not quite the same thing," Madame Virginsky tried to check her.
"I think the answer to this question wouldn't be quite discreet," answered Stavrogin. "How so?" said the girl student, craning forward suddenly. But there was an audible titter in the group of teachers, which was at once caught up at the other end by Lyamshin and the schoolboy, and followed by a hoarse chuckle from the major.
"You ought to write vaudevilles," Madame Virginsky observed to Stavrogin.
"It does you no credit. I don't know what your name is," the girl rapped out with positive indignation.
"And don't you be too forward," boomed the major. "You are a young lady, and you ought to behave modestly. And you keep jumping about as though you were sitting on a needle.
Kindly hold your tongue and don't address me familiarly with your nasty comparisons. I've never seen you before, and I don't recognize the relationship."
"But I am your uncle. I used to carry you about when you were a baby."
I don't care what babies you used to carry about. I didn't ask you to carry me. It must have been a pleasure to you to do so, you rude officer. And allow me to observe, don't dare to address me so familiarly, unless it's as a fellow citizen. I forbid you to do it once for all.
There, they're all like that, cried the major, banging the table with his fist and addressing Stavrogin, who was sitting opposite. But allow me. I am fond of liberalism and modern ideas, and I am fond of listening to clever conversation. Masculine conversation, though, I warn you. But to listen to these women, these knightly windmills, no, that makes me ache all over. Don't wriggle about, he shouted to the girl, who was leaping up from her chair. No, it is my turn to speak. I've been insulted.
You can't say anything yourself and only hinder other people talking, the lady of the house grumbled indignantly.
No, I will have my say, said the major hotly, addressing Stavrogin. I reckon on you, Mr. Stavrogin, as a fresh person who has only just come on the scene, though I haven't the honour of knowing you. Without men, they'll perish like flies, that's what I think. All their woman question is only lack of originality. I assure you that all this woman question has been invented for them by men in foolishness and to their own hurt. I only thank God I am not married. There's not the slightest variety in them. They can't even invent a simple pattern. They have to get men to invent them for them. Here I used to carry her in my arms, used to dance the mazurka with her when she was 10 years old. Today she's come. Naturally I fly to embrace her, and at the second word she tells me there's no God. She might have waited a little. She was in too great a hurry. Clever people don't believe, I dare say, but that's from their cleverness. But you, chicken, what do you know about God, I said to her, some student taught you, and if he'd taught you to light the lamp before the icons, you would have lighted it.
You keep telling lies. You are a very spiteful person. I proved to you just now the untenability of your position, the girl answered contemptuously, as though disdaining further explanations with such a man. I told you just now that we've all been taught in the catechism, if you honour your father and your parents, you will live long and have wealth. That's in the Ten Commandments. If God thought it necessary to offer rewards for love, your God must be immoral. That's how I proved it to you. It wasn't the second word, and it was because you asserted your rights. It's not my fault if you are stupid and don't understand even now. You are offended and you are spiteful, and that's what explains all your generation.
You're a goose, said the major,
and you are a fool.
You can call me names.
"Excuse me, Kapitan Maximych. You told me yourself you don't believe in God," Liputin piped from the other end of the table.
"What if I did say so? That's a different matter. I believe, perhaps, only not altogether. Even if I don't believe altogether, still I don't say God ought to be shot. I used to think about God before I left the Hussars. From all the poems you would think that Hussars do nothing but carouse and drink." Yes, I did drink, maybe. But would you believe it? I used to jump out of bed at night and stood crossing myself before the images with nothing but my socks on, praying to God to give me faith. For even then I couldn't be at peace as to whether there was a God or not. It used to fret me so. In the morning, of course, one would amuse oneself and one's faith would seem to be lost again. And in fact, I've noticed that faith always seems to be less in the daytime.
"Haven't you any cards?" asked Verhovinsky with a mighty yawn, addressing Madame Virginsky. "I sympathize with your question. I sympathize entirely," the girl student broke in hotly, flushed with indignation at the major's words.
"We are wasting precious time listening to silly talk," snapped out the lady of the house, as she looked reprovingly at her husband. The girl pulled herself together.
"I wanted to make a statement to the meeting concerning the sufferings of the students and their protest, but as time is being wasted in immoral conversation—" "There's no such thing as moral or immoral," the schoolboy brought out, unable to restrain himself as soon as the girl began. "I knew that, Mr. Schoolboy, long before you were taught it."
"And I maintain," he answered savagely, "that you are a child come from Petersburg to enlighten us all,
though we know for ourselves the commandment, "Honour thy father and thy mother," which you could not repeat correctly, and the fact that it's immoral, everyone in Russia knows from Bielinski.
"Are we ever to have an end of this?" Madame Virginsky said resolutely to her husband. As the hostess, she blushed for the ineptitude of the conversation, especially as she noticed smiles and even astonishment among the guests who had been invited for the first time.
"Gentlemen," said Virginsky, suddenly lifting up his voice, "if anyone wishes to say anything more nearly connected with our business, or has any statement to make, I call upon him to do so without wasting time."
"I'll venture to ask one question," said the lame teacher suavely. He had been sitting particularly decorously and had not spoken till then. "I should like to know, are we some sort of meeting, or are we simply a gathering of ordinary mortals paying a visit? I ask simply for the sake of order, and so as not to remain in ignorance."
This sly question made an impression. People looked at each other, everyone expecting someone else to answer, and suddenly all, as though at a word of command, turned their eyes to Verhovinsky and Stavrogin.
"I suggest our voting on the answer to the question whether we are in a meeting or not," said Madame Virginsky.
"I entirely agree with the suggestion," Liputin chimed in, "though the question is rather vague."
"I agree, too, and so do I," cried voices.
"I, too, think it would make our proceedings more in order," confirmed Virginsky.
"To the vote, then," said his wife. "Lyamshin, please sit down to the piano. You can give your vote from there when the voting begins."
"Again?" cried Lyamshin. "I've strummed enough for you."
"I beg you most particularly, sit down and play. Don't you care to do anything for the cause?"
"But I assure you, Arina Prohorovna, nobody is eavesdropping, it's only your fancy. Besides, the windows are high and people would not understand if they did hear."
"We don't understand ourselves," someone muttered.
"But I tell you, one must always be on one's guard. I mean, in case there should be spies," she explained to Verhovinsky. "Let them hear from the street that we have music and a name-day party."
"Hang it all," Lyamshin swore, and sitting down to the piano, began strumming a waltz, banging on the keys almost with his fists at random.
"I propose that those who want it to be a meeting should put up their right hands," Madame Virginsky proposed. Some put them up, others did not. Some held them up and then put them down again, and then held them up again.
"Pah! I don't understand it at all," one officer shouted.
"I don't either," cried the other.
"Oh, I understand," cried a third. "If it's yes, you hold your hand up."
"But what does yes mean?"
"Means a meeting."
"No, it means not a meeting."
"I voted for a meeting," cried the schoolboy to Madame Virginsky.
"Then why didn't you hold up your hand?"
"I was looking at you. You didn't hold up yours, so I didn't hold up mine."
"How stupid. I didn't hold up my hand because I proposed it. Gentlemen, I now propose the contrary. Those who want a meeting, sit still and do nothing. Those who don't, hold up their right hands."
"Those who don't want it?" inquired the schoolboy.
"Are you doing it on purpose?" cried Madame Virginsky wrathfully. "No, excuse me. Those who want it or those who don't want it, for one must know that definitely," cried two or three voices. "Those who don't want it. Those who don't want it."
"Yes, but what is one to do? Hold up one's hand or not hold it up if one doesn't want it?" cried an officer.
"Eh, we are not accustomed to constitutional methods yet," remarked the major.
"Mr. Lyamshin, excuse me, but you are thumping so that no one can hear anything," observed the lame teacher.
"But upon my word, Arina Prohorovna, nobody is listening, really," cried Lyamshin, jumping up. "I won't play. I've come to you as a visitor, not as a drummer."
"Gentlemen," Virginsky went on, "answer verbally. Are we a meeting or not?"
"We are, we are," was heard on all sides.
If so, there's no need to vote. That's enough. Are you satisfied, gentlemen? Is there any need to put it to the vote?
No need, no need, we understand.
Perhaps someone doesn't want it to be a meeting.
No, no, we all want it.
But what does meeting mean? Cried a voice.
No one answered.
We must choose a chairman, people cried from different parts of the room. Our host, of course, our host.
Gentlemen, if so, Virginsky, the chosen chairman, began, I propose my original motion. If anyone wants to say anything more relevant to the subject or has some statement to make, let him bring it forward without loss of time. There was a general silence. The eyes of all were turned again on Verhovinsky and Stavrogin.
Verhovinsky, have you no statement to make? Madame Virginsky asked him directly.
Nothing whatever, he answered, yawning and stretching on his chair. But I should like a glass of brandy.
Stavrogin, don't you want to?
Thank you, I don't drink.
I mean, don't you want to speak, not don't you want brandy?
To speak? What about?
No, I don't want to.
They'll bring you some brandy, she answered Verhovinsky.
The girl student got up. She had darted up several times already. I have come to make a statement about the sufferings of poor students and the means of rousing them to protest. But she broke off. At the other end of the table, a rival had risen, and all eyes turned to him. Shigalyov, the man with the long ears, slowly rose from his seat with a gloomy and sullen air, and mournfully laid on the table a thick notebook filled with extremely small handwriting. He remained standing in silence. Many people looked at the notebook in consternation, but Liputin, Virginsky, and the lame teacher seemed pleased.
"I ask leave to address the meeting," Shigalyov pronounced sullenly but resolutely.
"You have leave," Virginsky gave his sanction. The orator sat down, was silent for half a minute, and pronounced in a solemn voice,
"Gentlemen,
here's the brandy." The sister, who had been pouring out tea and had gone to fetch brandy, rapped out, contemptuously and disdainfully putting the bottle before Verhovinsky, together with the wine glass, which she brought in her fingers, without a tray or a plate. The interrupted orator made a dignified pause.
"Never mind, go on, I'm not listening," cried Verhovinsky, pouring himself out a glass.
"Gentlemen, asking your attention and, as you will see later, soliciting your aid in a matter of the first importance," Shigalyov began again, "I must make some prefatory remarks."
"Arina Prohorovna, haven't you some scissors?" Pyotr Stepanovich asked suddenly.
"What do you want scissors for?" she asked with wide-open eyes.
"I've forgotten to cut my nails. I've been meaning to for the last 3 days," he observed, scrutinizing his long and dirty nails with unruffled composure. Arina Prohorovna crimsoned, but Miss Virginsky seemed pleased.
"I believe I saw them just now on the window."
She got up from the table, went and found the scissors, and at once brought them. Pyotr Stepanovich did not even look at her, took the scissors and set to work with them. Arina Prohorovna grasped that these were realistic manners and was ashamed of her sensitiveness. People looked at one another in silence. The lame teacher looked vindictively and enviously at Verhovinsky. Shigalyov went on.
"Dedicating my energies to the study of the social organization which is in the future to replace the present condition of things, I've come to the conviction that all makers of social systems from ancient times up to the present year, 1870 some such, have been dreamers, tellers of fairy tales, fools who contradicted themselves, who understood nothing of natural science and the strange animal called man. Plato, Rousseau, Fourier, columns of aluminium, are only fit for sparrows and not for human society. But now that we are all at last preparing to act,
A new form of social organization is essential. In order to avoid further uncertainty, I propose my own system of world organization. Here it is.
He tapped the notebook.
I wanted to expound my views to the meeting in the most concise form possible, but I see that I should need to add a great many verbal explanations, and so the whole exposition would occupy at least 10 evenings, one for each of my chapters. There was the sound of laughter. I must add, besides, that my system is not yet complete. Laughter again. I am perplexed by my own data, and my conclusion is a direct contradiction of the original idea with which I start. Starting from unlimited freedom, I arrive at unlimited despotism. I will add, however, that there can be no solution of the social problem but mine.
The laughter grew louder and louder, but it came chiefly from the younger and less initiated visitors. There was an expression of some annoyance on the faces of Madame Virginsky, Liputin, and the lame teacher.
"If you've been unsuccessful in making your system consistent and have been reduced to despair yourself, what could we do with it?"
one officer observed warily.
"You are right, Mr. Officer," Shigalyov turned sharply to him, "especially in using the word despair. Yes, I am reduced to despair. Nevertheless, nothing can take the place of the system set forth in my book, and there is no other way out of it. No one can invent anything else. And so I hasten, without loss of time, to invite the whole society to listen for 10 evenings to my book, and then give their opinions of it. If the members are unwilling to listen to me, let us break up from the start. The men to take up service under government, the women to their cooking. For if you reject my solution, you'll find no other. None whatever. If they let the opportunity slip, it will simply be their loss, for they will be bound to come back to it again."
There was a stir in the company.
"Is he mad or what?" voices asked.
"So the whole point lies in Shigalyov's despair," Lyamshin commented, "and the essential question of whether he must despair or not."
"Shigalyov's being on the brink of despair is a personal question," declared the schoolboy.
"I propose we put it to a vote how far Shigalyov's despair affects the common cause, and at the same time whether it's worth listening to him or not," an officer suggested gaily.
"That's not right," the lame teacher put in his spoke at last.
As a rule, he spoke with a rather mocking smile, so that it was difficult to make out whether he was in earnest or joking.
"That's not right, gentlemen. Mr. Shigalyov is too much devoted to his task and is also too modest. I know his book. He suggests as a final solution of the question the division of mankind into 2 unequal parts. One-tenth enjoys absolute liberty and unbounded power over the other 9/10. The others have to give up all individuality and become, so to speak, a herd, and through boundless submission will, by a series of regenerations, attain primeval innocence. Something like the Garden of Eden. They'll have to work, however. The measures proposed by the author for depriving 9/10 of mankind of their freedom and transforming them into a herd through the education of whole generations are very remarkable, founded on the facts of nature and highly logical. One may not agree with some of the deductions, but it would be difficult to doubt the intelligence and knowledge of the author. It's a pity that the time required, 10 evenings, is impossible to arrange for, or we might hear a great deal that's interesting."
"Can you be in earnest?" Madame Virginsky addressed the lame gentleman, with a shade of positive uneasiness in her voice. "When that man doesn't know what to do with people and so turns 9/10 of them into slaves? I've suspected him for a long time."
"You say that of your own brother?" asked the lame man.
"Relationship? Are you laughing at me?"
And besides, to work for aristocrats and to obey them as though they were gods is contemptible," observed the girl student fiercely.
"What I propose is not contemptible. It's paradise, an earthly paradise, and there can be no other on earth," Shigalyov pronounced authoritatively.
"For my part," said Lyamshin, "if I didn't know what to do with 9/10 of mankind, I'd take them and blow them up into the air instead of putting them in paradise. I'd only leave a handful of educated people who would live happily ever afterwards on scientific principles."
"No one but a buffoon can talk like that," cried the girl, flaring up.
"He is a buffoon, but he is of use," Madame Virginsky whispered to her.
"And possibly that would be the best solution of the problem," said Shigalyov, turning hotly to Lyamshin. "You certainly don't know what a profound thing you've succeeded in saying, my merry friend. But as it's hardly possible to carry out your idea, we must confine ourselves to an earthly paradise, since that's what they call it."
"This is pretty thorough rot," broke, as though involuntarily, from Verhovinsky. Without even raising his eyes, however, he went on cutting his nails with perfect nonchalance.
"Why is it rot?" The lame man took it up instantly, as though he had been lying in wait for his first words to catch at them. "Why is it rot? Mr. Shigalyov is somewhat fanatical in his love for humanity, but remember that Fourier, still more Cabet, and even Proudhon himself advocated a number of the most despotic and even fantastic measures. Mr. Shigalyov is perhaps far more sober in his suggestions than they are. I assure you that when one reads his book, it's almost impossible not to agree with some things. He is perhaps less far from realism than anyone, and his earthly paradise is almost the real one, if it ever existed, for the loss of which man is always sighing."
"I knew I was in for something," Verhovinsky muttered again.
"Allow me," said the lame man, getting more and more excited. "Conversations and arguments about the future organization of society are almost an actual necessity for all thinking people nowadays. Herzen was occupied with nothing else all his life. Bielinski, as I know on very good authority, used to spend whole evenings with his friends debating and settling beforehand even the minutest, so to speak, domestic details of the social organization of the future."
"Some people go crazy over it," the major observed suddenly.
"We are more likely to arrive at something by talking anyway than by sitting silent and posing as dictators," Liputin hissed, as though at last venturing to begin the attack.
"I didn't mean Shigalyov when I said it was rot," Verhovensky mumbled. "You see, gentlemen," he raised his eyes a trifle, "to my mind all these books, Fourier, Cabet, all this talk about the right to work, and Shigalyov's theories, are all like novels of which one can write 100,000, an aesthetic entertainment. I can understand that in this little town you are bored, so you rush to ink and paper."
"Excuse me," said the lame man, wriggling on his chair. "Though we are provincials, and of course objects of commiseration on that ground, yet we know that so far nothing has happened in the world new enough to be worth our weeping at having missed it. It is suggested to us in various pamphlets made abroad and secretly distributed that we should unite and form groups with the sole object of bringing about universal destruction. It's urged that however much you tinker with the world, you can't make a good job of it, but that by cutting off 100 million heads and so lightening one's burden, one can jump over the ditch more safely. A fine idea, no doubt, but quite as impracticable as Shigalyov's theories, which you referred to just now so contemptuously."
"Well, but I haven't come here for discussion." Verhovinsky let drop this significant phrase, and, as though quite unaware of his blunder, drew the candle nearer to him, that he might see better.
"It's a pity, a great pity, that you haven't come for discussion, and it's a great pity that you are so taken up just now with your toilet."
"What's my toilet to you?"
"To remove 100 million heads is as difficult as to transform the world by propaganda.
Possibly more difficult, especially in Russia, Liputin ventured again.
It's Russia they rest their hopes on now, said an officer.
We've heard they are resting their hopes on it, interposed the lame man. We know that a mysterious finger is pointing to our delightful country as the land most fitted to accomplish the great task. But there's this. By the gradual solution of the problem by propaganda, I shall gain something anyway. I shall have some pleasant talk, at least, and shall even get some recognition from the government for my services to the cause of society. But in the second way, by the rapid method of cutting off 100 million heads, what benefit shall I get, personally? If you begin advocating that, your tongue might be cut out.
You certainly would be, observed Verhovinsky.
You see? And as under the most favourable circumstances you would not get through such a massacre in less than 50, or at the best 30 years, for they are not sheep, you know, and perhaps they would not let themselves be slaughtered. Wouldn't it be better to pack one's bundle and migrate to some quiet island beyond calm seas, and there close one's eyes tranquilly? Believe me, he tapped the table significantly with his finger, you will only promote emigration by such propaganda, and nothing else.
He finished, evidently triumphant. He was one of the intellects of the province.
Liputin smiled slyly. Virginsky listened rather dejectedly. The others followed the discussion with great attention, especially the ladies and officers. They all realized that the advocate of the 100 million heads theory had been driven into a corner, and waited to see what would come of it.
That was a good saying of yours, though, Verhovinsky mumbled more carelessly than ever, in fact with an air of positive boredom. Emigration is a good idea, but all the same, if in spite of all the obvious disadvantages you foresee, more and more come forward every day ready to fight for the common cause, it would be able to do without you. It's a new religion, my good friend, coming to take the place of the old one. That's why so many fighters come forward, and it's a big movement. You'd better emigrate. And you know, I should advise Dresden, not the Calm Islands to begin with. It's a town that has never been visited by an epidemic, and as you are a man of culture, no doubt you're afraid of death. Another thing, it's near the Russian frontier, so you can more easily receive your income from your beloved fatherland. Thirdly, it contains what are called treasures of art, and you are a man of aesthetic tastes, formerly a teacher of literature, I believe. And finally, it has a miniature Switzerland of its own, to provide you with poetic inspiration, for no doubt you write verse. In fact, it's a treasure in a nutshell. There was a general movement, especially among the officers. In another instant, they would all have begun talking at once, but the lame man rose irritably to the bait.
No, perhaps I am not going to give up the common cause. You must understand that...
What? Would you join the quintet if I proposed it to you? Verhovinsky boomed suddenly, and he laid down the scissors.
Everyone seemed startled. The mysterious man had revealed himself too freely. He had even spoken openly of the quintet.
Everyone feels himself to be an honest man and will not shirk his part in the common cause, the lame man tried to wriggle out of it. But,
no, this is not a question which allows of a but, Verhovinsky interrupted, harshly and peremptorily. I tell you, gentlemen, I must have a direct answer. I quite understand that, having come here and having called you together myself, I am bound to give you explanations.
Again, an unexpected revelation. But I can give you none till I know what is your attitude to the subject. To cut the matter short, for we can't go on talking for another 30 years as people have done for the last 30, I ask you which you prefer. The slow way, which consists in the composition of socialistic romances and the academic ordering of the destinies of humanity 1,000 years hence, while despotism will swallow the savoury morsels which would almost fly into your mouths of themselves if you take a little trouble? Or do you, whatever it may imply, prefer a quicker way, which will at last untie your hands and will let humanity make its own social organisation in freedom and in action, not on paper? They shout 100 million heads. That may be only a metaphor, but why be afraid of it? If, with the slow daydream on paper, despotism in the course of some 100 years will devour not 100 but 500 million heads. Take note, too, that an incurable invalid will not be cured whatever prescriptions are written for him on paper. On the contrary, if there is delay, he will grow so corrupt that he will infect us, too, and contaminate all the fresh forces which one might still reckon upon now, so that we shall all at last come to grief together. I thoroughly agree that it's extremely agreeable to chatter liberally and eloquently, but action is a little trying. However, I am no hand at talking. I came here with communications, and so I beg all the honourable company not to vote, but simply and directly to state which you prefer, walking at a snail's pace in the marsh, or putting on full steam to get across it.
"I am certainly for crossing at full steam," cried the schoolboy in an ecstasy.
"So am I," the Amtian chimed in. "There can be no doubt about the choice," muttered an officer, followed by another, then by someone else. What struck them all most was that Verhovensky had come with communications and had himself just promised to speak. "Gentlemen, I can see that almost all decide for the policy of the manifestos," he said, looking round at the company.
"All, all," cried the majority of voices. "I confess I am rather in favour of a more humane policy," said the major. "But as all are on the other side, I go with all the rest."
"It appears, then, that even you are not opposed to it," said Verhovensky, addressing the lame man. "I am not exactly," said the latter, turning rather red. "But if I do agree with the rest now, it's simply not to break up. You are all like that. Ready to argue for 6 months to practice your liberal eloquence, and in the end you're both the same as the rest. Gentlemen, consider, though. Is it true that you are all ready?"
"Ready for what?" The question was vague but very alluring.
"All are, of course," voices were heard, but all were looking at one another. "But afterwards perhaps you will resent having agreed so quickly. That's almost always the way with you." The company was excited in various ways, greatly excited. The lame man flew at him. "Allow me to observe, however, that answers to such questions are conditional. Even if we have given our decision, you must note that questions put in such a strange way..." "In what strange way?" "In a way such questions are not asked." "Teach me how, please. But do you know, I felt sure you'd be the first to take offence." "You've extracted from us an answer as to our readiness for immediate action, but what right had you to do so? By what authority do you ask such questions? You should have thought of asking that question sooner. Why did you answer? You agree and then you go back on it. But to my mind, the irresponsibility of your principal question suggests to me that you have no authority, no right, and only asked from personal curiosity."
"What do you mean? What do you mean?" cried Verhovensky, apparently beginning to be much alarmed.
"Why, that the initiation of new members into anything you like is done anyway, tête-à-tête, and not in the company of 20 people one doesn't know," blurted out the lame man. He had said all that was in his mind because he was too irritated to restrain himself. Verhovensky turned to the general company with a capitally simulated look of alarm. "Gentlemen, I deem it my duty to declare that all this is folly, and that our conversation has gone too far. I have so far initiated no one, and no one has the right to say of me that I initiate members. We were simply discussing our opinions. That's so, isn't it? But whether that's so or not, you alarm me very much." He turned to the lame man again. "I had no idea that it was unsafe here to speak of such practically innocent matters except tête-à-tête. Are you afraid of informers? Can there possibly be an informer among us here?" The excitement became tremendous. All began talking. "Gentlemen, if that is so," Verhovensky went on, "I have compromised myself more than anyone, and so I will ask you to answer one question, if you care to, of course. You are all perfectly free."
"What question? What question?" everyone clamoured.
"A question that will make it clear whether we are to remain together, or take up our hats and go our several ways without speaking."
"The question, the question!"
If any one of us knew of a proposed political murder, would he, in view of all the consequences, go to give information, or would he stay at home and await events? Opinions may differ on this point. The answer to the question will tell us clearly whether we are to separate or to remain together, and for far longer than this one evening. Let me appeal to you first. He turned to the lame man. Why to me first? Because you began it all. Be so good as not to prevaricate. It won't help you to be cunning. But please yourself, it's for you to decide.
Excuse me, but such a question is positively insulting.
No, can't you be more exact than that?
I've never been an agent of the secret police, replied the latter, wriggling more than ever.
Be so good as to be more definite. Don't keep us waiting. The lame man was so furious that he left off answering. Without a word, he glared wrathfully from under his spectacles at his tormentor.
Yes or no? Would you inform or not? Cried Verhovensky.
Of course I wouldn't, the lame man shouted twice as loudly. No one would, of course not, cried many voices.
Allow me to appeal to you, Mr. Major. Would you inform or not? Verhovensky went on. And note that I appeal to you on purpose.
I won't inform.
But if you knew that someone meant to rob and murder someone else, an ordinary mortal, then you would inform and give warning.
Yes, of course. But that's a private affair, while the other would be a political treachery. I've never been an agent of the secret police. And no one here has, voices cried again. It's an unnecessary question. Everyone will make the same answer. There are no informers here.
What is that gentleman getting up for? Cried the girl student.
That's Shatov. What are you getting up for? Cried the lady of the house.
Shatov did, in fact, stand up. He was holding his cap in his hand and looking at Verhovensky. Apparently he wanted to say something to him, but was hesitating. His face was pale and wrathful, but he controlled himself. He did not say one word, but in silence walked towards the door.
Shatov, this won't make things better for you, Verhovensky called after him enigmatically. But it will for you, since you were a spy and a scoundrel, Shatov shouted to him from the door, and he went out.
Shouts and exclamations again.
That's what comes of a test, cried a voice. It's been of use, cried another.
Hasn't it been of use too late? Observed a third.
Who invited him? Who let him in? Who is he? Who is Shatov? Will he inform or won't he?
There was a shower of questions.
If he were an informer, he would have kept up appearances instead of cursing it all and going away, observed someone.
See, Stavrogin is getting up too. Stavrogin has not answered the question either, cried the girl student.
Stavrogin did actually stand up, and at the other end of the table, Kirillov rose at the same time.
Excuse me, Mr. Stavrogin, Madame Virginsky addressed him sharply. We all answered the question, while you are going away without a word.
I see no necessity to answer the question which interests you, muttered Stavrogin.
But we've compromised ourselves, and you won't, shouted several voices. What business is it of mine if you have compromised yourselves? Laughed Stavrogin, but his eyes flashed.
What business? What business? Voices exclaimed.
Many people got up from their chairs.
Allow me, gentlemen, allow me, cried the lame man. Mr. Verhovensky hasn't answered the question either. He has only asked it.
The remark produced a striking effect. All looked at one another. Stavrogin laughed aloud in the lame man's face and went out. Kirillov followed him. Verhovensky ran after them into the passage.
What are you doing?
He faltered, seizing Stavrogin's hand and gripping it with all his might in his. Stavrogin pulled away his hand without a word.
Be at Kirillov's directly. I'll come. It's absolutely necessary for me to see you.
It isn't necessary for me,
Stavrogin cut him short.
Stavrogin will be there, Kirillov said finally. Stavrogin, it is necessary for you. I will show you that there.
They went out.